All right. Good evening. Tonight is November 8th, 2011. This is the West Covina Unified School District Board of Education regular meeting. It's called to order at 6:30. We will be going to a closed session to readmit one student and talk about some personnel issues. Is there anybody who wishes to address the board regarding closed session items? Seeing none, we will then adjourn to closed session. Good evening. Welcome to the West Covina Board of Education regular meeting of November 8th, 2011. We've now returned from closed session, and we'll open regular session at 7 o'clock. I'd like to start this evening with an invocation and a flag salute. Will you please rise for a moment of silence? And I'd ask, as you prepare yourselves, that you remember our student that was killed in Mexico, Nick Aronson, in your thoughts. Thank you. Will you please join me in the flag salute? Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call, please.
Mr. Cox?
Here.
Mrs. Menendez?
Here.
Ms. Shoemaker?
Here.
Mrs. Polis?
Here.
Mr. Spence?
Here.
Ms. Madenhead?
Here.
And Mrs. Kaplan?
Here.
We had one item this evening in closed session. The following action was taken in closed session, with the subsequent action being reported in open session as required by law. It was moved by Cami Polis, seconded by Jessica Shoemaker, that the following student has completed his terms and conditions of expulsion and has been approved by the Board of Education for readmittance to West Covina Unified School District. Student number 182314 to lift the expulsion and enroll at West Covina High School. It was voted and it was 4-0-1 with Mr. Spence absent. Any board reports, Mr. Spence?
Yes.
Anything?
I had the opportunity to go to the Oktoberfest at West Cove, and it was awesome. They did a fantastic job. All of the students, and it looked like even the teachers, I don't know who had more fun, the adults or the students there. And I know that other schools put them on. I didn't have the opportunity to be there, but I'm sure they were just as well done. And so I just appreciate all the extra effort that people put into the project. I also had the opportunity to go take a tour of California Mental Health Connections. They serve individuals with some mental health issues, and I know they do some volunteer work in our district. I'm going to pass on the brochures I got on, but they're a multicultural organization, and the tour was fantastic, so it'd be nice to get to know more about them, especially since we don't have the AB 3632 funds anymore. And the last but not least, I want to thank the Coronado staff for helping the Parents Place. We're partnering with them to put on the transition conference. The transition conference they put on annually is for young adults that are transitioning from special ed into adults, going in either to college, into jobs, and it shows their parents and them how to successfully plan for that. And my son was able to speak about his successful transition from West Covina Unified into adulthood. And I thought he did a fantastic job. So I'm just going to pass these on. And then the Parents Place put together a transition, a list of all the transition resources available. And so I'm passing that on too, just in case we don't have it here in the district.
Thank you.
And that's all I had to report.
Thank you. Megan? Student representative report.
Good evening. Unfortunately, tonight I do not have a Coronado High School report, but I do have Edgewood and West Covina. For Edgewood, their clubs are becoming very, very active. They actually raise $200 for their UNICEF club in their event, Trick or Treat, so kids can eat. Wow. So that is very, very cool. Their service club is officially recognized as a part of Interact. Their mock trial is competing against other schools, and their decathlon is having their first scrimmage this Friday. So they're looking forward to all of that. Their winter sports are having tryouts now, and their cross country is having a jogathon on November 17th. For their academics, their IB representatives visited their school, and their grading period is just about to end, coming up, I think, next Friday. And they're having a fresh and easy fundraiser going on through December, a canned food drive on November 17th, and they're having one of their first Spirit Weeks next week. So that's for Edgewood. For West Covina, we are preparing for the WASC visitation, trying to showcase our school, and they're going to identify our strengths, and we're going to learn the areas for our growth. And that all begins this Sunday, November 13th. The VORD is invited to come as well. It starts at 2:45 and will be in the Media Center. There will be a tour given at 4 o'clock. So they'll be here this Sunday through this Wednesday, November 16th. Along with that, our second grading period also closes next Friday, and we had a Freshman 101 assembly today, and last week we celebrated College Week. We had a big Renaissance rally, and it was really great. As far as our sports go, girls golf just made it to first round CIF, and Alexis Valenzuela, one of our juniors, is a third year league champion, so we are so excited for her. That is amazing. Our Fine Arts Senior Night is this Thursday. We'll be celebrating football, cheer, band, and dance drill. And Band and Color Guard have also had an excellent season so far. They've won multiple sweepstakes award, and they are hosting their 21st annual Holiday Classic tonight and tomorrow night at our field. And also along with that, I just noticed today our library is now accessible online. So it's really cool. You go to the website, and it shows you what books are available, which ones are checked out. It shows the staff top picks, and it's just, I think that's a really good resource for all of us. So our librarian emailed all the students at school, so we all have access to that. And that's everything. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next item on the agenda is items from the floor, public comment. Is there anybody that would like to speak to the board this evening? Seeing none, we'll move on to the next item, the organizational item, and the business session and the organizational items. To approve the agenda and the consent items. Anybody like to remove something from consent or add something to consent? Hearing nothing. Is there a motion, please?
I'll second it.
Moved by Eileen Miranda Jimenez and seconded by Cami Polis to approve the agenda and consent items for the regular meeting November 8th. Any objections? Hearing none, the motion so ordered. Next item on the agenda is item number 9, a information report regarding the categorical programs and an annual update.
Well, it might be able to be arranged. So.
Thank you.
Thank you for making the screen big. Thank you.
It'll come on, I think.
Oh, sorry, I didn't have the hand. Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. Give it just a moment to warm up. Good evening. Good evening. It's my pleasure to come before you this evening, so thank you very much. It's every year we're required to make sure that we inform the board about our accountability. And so we evaluate the effectiveness of our categorical programs, particularly EIA, Title III, and Title I, because they are on the consolidated application. And last year we came before you and brought our Title III plan. For EIA and Title III, we are considered program improvement in West Covina Unified, Year 3. And for the reason is for our what we call annual measurable achievement objectives, became very long, so I kind of put the AMAO, which is the acronym, for obtaining English proficiency for our long-terms English learners, as well as AMAO3 for meeting proficiency rates for English learners in mathematics. We did write that plan, which the board approved, which addressed our areas of need, particularly to be able to monitor our student progress, professional development, and parent involvement. The real reason that I need to come before you is now about Title I, because now this is new information. I know you've gotten updates, and much of this you do already know. Just a refresher is for Title I in our district that we fund our elementary schools, so this information is pertinent to our elementary schools only. Title I has specific accountabilities. One is the Academic Performance Index, or API, and over the past 3 years, you can see that steady growth that has happened for all of our schools that receive Title I. And we met the federal goal for 2010-11, and in fact, because all of our elementary schools are now 800 and above, we've actually met the state requirement of being 800. And we've surpassed, so we've actually met that, and we're ahead of the game there. Now, when we look at English language arts, we have annual yearly progress targets. The arrow is pointed to the 2010 and 11 because this is the data that we're looking at that we currently have. As you note, you'll see from 2009 to 10, because that's the data I've provided with you, you'll see that this is a climb. And if I'd shown you where it started fairly gradual, and now we're on that very steep incline with the expectation by 2014 that 100% of the students will be proficient. In 2007, it happened to be for our district 67.6. For English language arts, you'll note here's across the schools, and you'll see steady increases since 2009. And it ranges between the schools, but we've seen some nice progress over time with everyone moving upward. Math as well is that steep incline with the expectation by 2014, 100% of the students will be proficient, but this past year was at 68.5. When you look at the three-year overview, once again, you'll see some really nice increases, very strong in our mathematic area as teachers have become probably more proficient with our new curriculum and understanding how to teach the concepts. But yet we have people who have met and not met targets. Meeting the targets for our Title I requirements is Merced, Merlinda, Monte Vista, San Jose, and West Cove for 2010 and 11. And not meeting targets include the district office as the LEA, California, Cameron, Orangewood, and Vine. So what does this mean? We have schools in our district which we considered on watch. For the district, we had areas for language arts and math, particularly, as you had heard before, our African-American subgroup. We also have grades 6 through 8 and students with disabilities that have areas of need. Cameron, I apologize, I see a typo in there. It's for English learners for both English language arts and math that they did not meet that. Orangewood, in English language arts, there are subgroups of school-wide, Hispanic, and socioeconomically disadvantaged students did not meet the federal target, if you refer back to your previous pages of where those were at, and at Vine Elementary as well. In the area of math, Hispanics, as well as the socioeconomic disadvantaged students did not meet the targets. So these groups here are what we consider on watch for program improvement. They did not meet one or more of their subgroups or overall. And because of that, for the schools particularly, we provide assistance, the technical assistance in ensuring that they're looking at their school plans and they're implementing them, and we're providing them with the support necessary. Additional professional development, classroom observations, collecting instructional data and sharing that with both administrators as well as teachers. The student performance data, and that's not just the CST and the CELT, but it's also then their benchmarks and their grades and how they're performing. Monitoring program implementation for the core programs, as well as monitor the expenditures that are happening at the schools to make sure that they're aligned with the plans. Now, program improvement. This year we have California Elementary, who was identified for program improvement year one. And the reason is because in 2009-10, the Hispanic subgroup did not meet one of the target, but in 10 and 11, English learners and socioeconomic disadvantage did not meet the target. So even though it's different groups of population, the way the accountability is written, If you do not meet it for 2 years in a row for a subgroup, doesn't matter if the subgroups match or not, you still fall within program improvement. So even though there's not a consistent pattern, the way the accountability is written caused California to fall into program improvement this year. And with that comes school responsibilities that they had to, within the last 3 months, revise their school plan with for an overview of a two-year. They had to set goals for 2 years. They have to use a minimum of 10% of their personal Title I funds for professional development, and once the board approves their plan, that they implement it promptly. With the district for accountabilities for their responsibilities for program improvement is that we provide that technical assistance to them in revising their plan, providing professional development, and monitoring the student progress. Additionally, we must notify parents of what we call the PI status as well as school choice. And what that means is we had to send out a letter that told parents, one, that they were program improvement and that they had an option to move us to a school that is not identified as program improvement. And with that, we have to set aside a required 20% of the Title I total budget for the purposes of transportation as well as an additional 5% of professional development to identify these areas of need for program improvement. With that comes supports, and this is for all of, for California as well as the schools on watch, as well as many of our Title I schools do participate in these activities depending on their areas of need. But it's that monitoring of the implementation of the school plan, making sure that they're following through with what they said and what you approved, that there's frequent classroom observations, just not only by the district office but also by the administrator, collect and interpret that implementation data, that are the teachers teaching the core program as it was designed, are they using the good strategies, as well as then the performance data of their benchmarks and standardized test scores. Additionally, professional development is offered for both principals and co-administrators for the leadership piece of it. In many of the things that we implement, such as lesson study, thinking maps, meeting the diversity of the needs of our special populations, such as English learners and students with disabilities. And then we also have quite a bit of teacher training that happens to support. So it's differentiated depending on what your role is, but that everybody has a concept and an understanding of what the goal is and that we're moving towards it together as a team. And I just wanted to put this into perspective, so I wanted to show you how we compared at our district according to our kind of our local region. I probably missed a district or two, but you can see we are highlighted there, having the one school out of the nine in program improvement. Our district currently is not in program improvement, but you can see we're faring pretty well. Because I just want to give you this big picture, and I'm sure you keep up with the news and you hear much of this, but the Title I or ESEA or Elementary Secondary Education Act, whatever you want to call it, is currently expired. But the accountabilities and sanctions remain. So there's been a lot of information in the news. There's no timeline currently for the reauthorization, but there's a bill currently in the Senate. It's called the Hastings Bill that started off about 600 pages, and I've heard it's up to about 900 pages now as they go through the markup and going back and forth of how do they want ESA to look. But they haven't determined that, and we don't know quite when that'll happen. So the federal government actually offered a waiver that California is contemplating to actually participate in. They'll be speaking at the State Department of Education about the waiver at their next board meeting to determine if California will actually participate or not. Should they choose to participate in the waiver, our status of program improvement and such will revert back to what we were last year. So we will keep you updated and informed as information comes to us.
On the professional development segments, you said that there's a 10% at California, and then the money has to be used for professional development?
Correct.
And then the district, 5%?
5% of our Title I.
So that a total of 15, or is that two separate funds?
It's when the Title I money comes to us, of the total allocation, 5% must be taken off the top as a required set-aside.
Okay.
And then once the school gets their allocation, it's 10% of their budget. So it doesn't equal 15% of the total.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? No. Spence? Go ahead.
I had a question about the allocation of resources. You know, we've talked about that quite a bit. I'm still, because of the different every time we talked about it, there was a different numbers given to us. But my question was, is that, you know, for example, like Orangewood didn't participate in, I think it was the Microsoft funding, or one of the funding programs. And I'm trying to figure out, like, some of the schools that, for whatever reason, the district allocated funds differently than having it follow the child, how that would impact those that didn't make the goals.
I can't speak to the Microsoft money, but for the Title I piece of it, it's very clear on how it's allocated. Of the schools that are at or above the district poverty line are funded. Those that are below the district poverty line, the board has the discretion to alternatively rank them and still fund them as long as they meet the 35%. And then there's the formula of everyone kind of getting their base amount and then the supplemental amount to the schools that are above the district poverty line. Mm-hmm. Is Microsoft money or any other money calculated in that? No.
Right. Well, because like Vine, for example, is one of those that doesn't get because it doesn't falls beneath the poverty line. But yet
right, they get their base amount.
Compared to some of our other schools, have problems meeting their targets.
Correct. This year they are on watch.
And so, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out if there's another way or how we should be looking at that or how we, I guess, in the future should be tackling those kinds of issues.
I think that's a valid concern, and I know it is under consideration every year of how we do fund them to making sure we're maximizing with following the guidelines that we're given for Title I of how it's distributed. Because Title I, as you know, is distributed based on poverty rate. And so the schools above on a higher poverty rate must be funded at a higher rate than the ones below them. That answer here, or did there more?
I guess that's something to talk about in the future.
Right, I think it's good.
When we deal with the consolidated items in the future.
My question, you said that parents had to be notified of the PI status and
correct.
Given the opportunity to move to a different school. Has anybody exercised that?
We got one request for a school that was not listed as one of the choice options, but we only had one request at this point, and we have not been successful in reaching the family, but we're sending a letter home, and hopefully they'll contact us. We did have a meeting, and if you have questions, Ms. Wiles was there as well. She's on the next item here. We had a lovely meeting where we did a morning session and an afternoon session. It's not required, but we offered it to the parents. Really, you know, they were surprised by the information because when they look at it, they see that their school's doing good. I mean, they've got good scores, right? But so they just want to know how could we be in this pot, right? How could we be identified as program improvement? And so by the end, they were really arguing with us of this is a good school if we shouldn't be getting the title. They didn't want to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And
how many people would you say overall?
It wasn't a very high turnout, and I got very few calls, and more of it was just clarification.
We had 16 parents at the morning meeting and 9 at the evening meeting.
So I think California parents are very happy with what's happening at the school, and they see really good things happening. And they understand that, you know, and talking about this big picture, is that we're now seeing, you know, if I go back here, you know, to this how do we compare, where you have, you know, Walnut and Glendora and Charter Oak, these are the schools that we really have seen as being, you know, kind of our competitors of, you know, we're at this high academic level of falling into program improvement. It's no longer schools that are unsuccessful being identified. It's now schools that are successful having areas of need being identified. And I don't want to look at this and say we don't take this seriously because we do, but we want to keep it in the context is they have some really good results as well. And so that's the argument at the national level right now is about 80, I think they said by the end of this year, 80% of the schools will be identified as program improvement. They should ride. You're a math person, Mr. Cox. You know, that's kind of bad numbers if everyone's being identified, of really identifying where the need is. So when you look at that big picture and you read the current information, it's really stating more, let's identify the schools truly that are in need and target them. But until they reauthorize the law, we're caught in that. We will follow it. We will do everything we can because we take it seriously in our district.
So since no student other than the one has asked to leave and we have to set aside 20% for transportation, what do the guidelines tell us where we can now spend it if we're not using it toward transportation?
We'll send out another identification probably in January to make sure that there's, you know, one last opportunity with that. From there, then based on needs assessment and performance, then it can be used for other required set-asides or assistance to schools, and then we can distribute based on a funding model.
Okay, so then it would be distributed to all the schools, or it would have to go specifically to California?
Depending on what our needs are and when we look at that.
Cammie?
To piggyback on her question, the parents that are given the option, do all parents have the option to move or only socially, economically disadvantaged parents?
All students do have the option in our district right now. It's a good problem to have. We're actually, you know, quite full in many of our schools and classrooms. Should there be, if we became too full and could not, let's say she had 15 students that wanted to move out of fifth grade. I happen to know we don't have 15 slots open at different sites right now. Then what would happen is it would have to go to the lowest achieving, lowest socioeconomic student first and given that opportunity.
Okay. And then it would just go up the line?
And it would go up the line, and then we would have to come up with a plan of how to resolve that for the future. So if we had that many students wanting to leave the campus, that we could accommodate them in the future.
And then on page 9, the slide that says, how do we compare, there's asterisks next to several of them. And
those
they seem to be the lowest, or
yeah.
The one with the most...
Yes, and I should have explained that. I apologize. Those are the districts that are actually district PI. So not only do they have schools in PI, their district is identified for program improvement. And with all of them, they're either year 2 or year 3 program improvement.
So 5 of them.
And that's in our, you know, area. If you take that and look into other, you know, local areas, what we call kind of consortiums, you'll see, you know, some of the areas it's 100%, you know, and my lovely district of Los Angeles Unified that I used to work in, depending on your neighborhood or your cluster, or your local district, you could have 100% of the schools actually identified.
Well, those were my only two questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Next item on the agenda is California Elementary Single Plan for Student Achievements.
As Mrs. Taylor indicated, over the past 3 months, she's worked with California to rewrite their single plan. That was provided in your packet over the weekend. If you have any questions about the modification of that plan, Mrs. Taylor and Mrs. Wilds are here to answer those questions.
Anybody?
I have a couple questions about that.
Go ahead. Who first? You go first.
Okay. Just on the overall plan, I guess, I had a couple questions. I guess first, I'll skip to the last part first. The part of the goals on page 2243, where all but one of the goals was met, right? On page 22, goal 1, 2, and 3 weren't met, and goal 4 says were met. And I guess the question I have is, you know, goals 1, 2, and 3 have, like, specific numbers and specific goals as far as, like, how many kids will be scoring here and there, while goal number 4 says, you know, California will be safe and, you know, a drug-free learning environment. You know, it doesn't have, like, specific goals on, you know, that you would achieve. And so is that why we met that goal? Because it didn't have specific numbers? But, you know, I'm trying to attain how we actually...
Right. I'll turn that piece over to Mrs. Wilds because we have a principal transition here. It's part of the reason I'm going to speak. One, for the goals 1, 2, and 3, part of schools make their set their own personal goals that not don't have to necessarily mirror the exact goals for the federal government. So that's why California, when you look at the how the students transition between the schools, they saw the growth that was what they had anticipated and which they had wanted for those schools. For goal 5,
four.
Or goal 4, did you want to address somehow you and Mrs. Lessiker?
Good evening. I'm Lori Wilds, principal of California School. Goal 4 is basically looked at the attendance records as far as how we met our monthly attendance and also looking at student referrals into the office to the principal and also suspensions as well at the school site. So that's how goal 4 was looked at, as whether it was met or not.
I understand that because it says that here. But, I mean, you don't have, like, specific goals. Like, we're not going to have more than so many suspensions because that's something that can be, you know, is there a rubric that we use district-wide to kind of judge those kinds of safety issues? Because you know, obviously you can reduce, you know, rates by not reporting or not, you know, but that doesn't mean you don't have a problem.
Right. We would never do that.
It's hard to see whether or not
correct.
You actually, what kind of standard.
Correct.
Know,
and that definitely can fluctuate throughout the years. I mean, with the attendance one, as you know, you've seen the steady increase of regular attendance, the decrease of attendance. So that one's a real easy one, as
yes,
well as the referrals for discipline. Mm-hmm. And that will be subjected to certain groups of, you know, who's on the campus. Sometimes you have, you know, some kids that have a little more needs than the others, and you can see that spike in up and down. Mm-hmm. But I know each school has a goal similar to this, is to making sure that that there's a positive discipline plan on the campus, that students are rewarded for their behavior and recognized for that, and that the referrals then that are coming are because that the students are needing, you know, that additional assistance for counseling and support in order to get them kind of back on that right track. And so those are the things that they're monitoring. And you're right, it's kind of hard to quantify to say, you know, this year it'll be 3 and next year it'll be 2 because it's a different population. But where you see a big spike, sometimes it's looking at personal reflections to say, okay, are we doing everything we need to do to make sure that the system's set up correctly first so students can succeed? And those are the things that they analyze and look at. And you're right, it is hard to quantify, but in the case for California, they really did see them putting into place some real positive discipline steps so that students were seeing much more success and not being referred to the office for things that, like I said, if you just put the right things in place, kids will tend to make the right decisions. And it was more about educating teachers sometimes about how to set that up, and the staff was very willing and participated in some training that's known through Fred Jones and really worked on that positive discipline.
Okay. And then I guess just turning back to page 20, just look at two of the different things. One is the gifted and talented students making excellent progress with staff. We need to provide increased differential instruction to challenge these students and strengthen the core curriculum. You know, that's something, you know, especially with gay students in technology, that's where, you know, I like talking about the individualization stuff because, I mean, you know, if you get a GATE student that's really committed to some area of study, you know, that you can't provide for normally a bunch of kids, we might be able to do something to do that. And so I don't know how we're looking at that.
All right. I think that's a good conversation to have about that. I know we've been providing differentiated training and support for mm-hmm. teachers. Within our core programs, particularly our language arts, there's something that's called, they should be doing a research project in developing that. I can say Mr. Cook and Mr. Goomerang have been working with staff at the school system to talk about project-based learning and how to implement that. So we have things in place at the district that we've been trying to, you know, provide teachers with the support they need and resources and knowledge how to do. As we look at, you know, we're a product of somewhat of our success. The more successful the students become, the more we need some of that individualization to continue to promote that higher piece. Ms. Valentine, I know, has done some information on the Common Core and where we're looking to that future. But I think that's a good conversation and things that we can bring to you or some information about what particular we're doing as we progress through the year.
Okay, and then the second part on the special education students, where it talks that reflects that these students need more reteaching, reinforcement, intervention to support standards of mastery, and you know, talk about the support that's needed there. And California was one of the schools that I think we had the PIP program at. Have we looked at what the impact of eliminating that program has been at the different school sites where we had that?
Mrs. Valentine, do you know?
I'm not sure if California was one of the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that whether or not Mrs. Lawson had information, data about the impact on the schools. Certainly that type of service, I think, will be included in our mental health services plan.
Okay.
Since we're taking back mental health services.
Okay, so we are going to be doing that then.
I think we have to look at the whole range of services. From what PIP was an early intervention,
right. Mm-hmm.
All the way to more severe cases. And I know that Kim Alexander has been working with our team of school psychologists on that full range of services.
Yeah, because it seems obviously, you know, from my point of view, I know it differed from the boards, but that, you know, having that type of program earlier on, you know, hopefully we can address some of those deficiencies earlier and get the support services there so that later on you're not trying to play catch up as much with some of those difficult situations. Mm-hmm. So when are we going to get that plan for mental health services, the whole thing?
Well, she gave you a little preview that
right.
was in the update. Mm-hmm. I think that they'll have a pretty much completed plan maybe by the end of first week of December. It's getting pulled together. She's met with several outside agencies about partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
With them, so.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. I was just wondering, there's little, it looks like there were Post-its throughout. Were there a reason for those, and were those specific areas that you were looking at? Like page 25, yeah. So I was looking at those, and I wasn't sure if those were where changes had been made.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
But there isn't a way in the software to show where a change was made.
Okay.
I wanted to be able to indicate to you in this long document a little bit more specifically where changes were made.
And the changes that were made were specific to California's needs, and because that they're now PI?
Yes.
And because they looked pretty generic, so I'm not sure.
Well, being new to the school site this year,
okay.
you know, I really, as you can see by the different meetings we had with
right.
school site council and Title I and EL parent meetings and ELAC meetings, we were really trying to get the input of everyone into regards to updating and revising the school plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming on board, my goal is also to monitor that implementation to the fullest extent as well. So that's, I hope that.
And the other thing to keep in context is even though there's program improvement and there's requirements, there were good things already happening. So there wasn't significant changes that were, you know, really found, oh, this is where we're failing at. There are needs. I mean, we don't want to take that, but there's continuous growth. We saw growth. We saw good things happening. So you don't want to take out the things that were working. So there were minimal changes in a sense and some revisions, but you wouldn't see, you know, the whole restructure of something because, you know, they've already gone through a big change.
Right. Well,
you know,
and that's when I was
trying to provide that support. So
the original plan, it looked pretty much the same.
Correct.
And then it looked...
Well, and you think of it, when Ms. Lessiker wrote this was at the end of last year, so there's a little bit of new data, but pretty much you're focusing on all the same information, and, it, you know, with Mrs. Wilds being new this year, the input that she's gotten from her stakeholders and coming together, creating and looking at that vision and making sure everybody is maybe more clearly articulating some of those things within the plan so people had a better perception and understanding of what would happen.
And since California is unique, being 3 through 6, would I be able to look at this plan and compare it to a traditional K-5 or K-6 and see differences because here you're reading to learn? And where would I look for that? Or would it not really show up in here?
The school plans are designed to be kind of the road map,
right?
You know, so you kind of see where to go. But the actual implementation, you would see more in probably the agendas, the professional development,
okay.
and the walkthrough of that piece of it than necessarily the detail. Otherwise, you would have a very large plan to have to read through.
Can I just respond a little bit? One of the things that our principals are doing now are providing yearly action plans and writing SMART goals specific to the data that they are looking at,
okay.
whether it be their ELL population. So in their action plans, I think you see more specific strategies that are being done this year for very specific goals with specific subgroups. So it's the next step, I guess, in terms of the school plan.
You had showed us in the board packet. That looked wonderful.
So it's very specific.
Okay.
This is more the umbrella.
And this doesn't really have anything to do with the plan. It has more to do with the PI. But when you looked at the data before you reconfigured, because I think it's more difficult to get a higher score in 3 to 6 than it would be for West Cove, which their scores went up. Is it going to be more difficult for a school with just 3rd through 6 to be able to make those kind of improvements that we've seen at the other schools? Just because of the age grouping.
You know, I think it's more, I think it's harder to grow when you're at the higher level and you're trying to get higher. I think when you are at the 60% or 50%, it's easier to show that growth because you're working with a group of students and really moving them up. The slower growth happens, I think, when they're at that top level and moving them up. So I don't think it should have, it's not really based on grade. It's really based on where they're starting and where they need to go.
Okay. Because I know our secondary schools seem to struggle, and but that's across California. It's just not. So it seemed as they got older, it was a little harder to meet the goal of 800. And I didn't know if the same thing would be true if you didn't, if you took the second graders out of the equation. It doesn't sound that way.
I think really what the schools are doing is looking very specifically at students who are not proficient and coming up with plans and moving them up. So I think it's really reaching those kids and moving them to the next level that's going to make the difference.
Thank you. Those are all my questions.
Thank you very much. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. All right. Thank you.
I'll move that.
It's been moved by Cami Polison, seconded by Eileen Miranda Jimenez, to approve the California Elementary School Single Plan for Student Achievement Preliminary Budget for the 2011-12 school year. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes 5-0. Item number 11 is another information report regarding the Project Tomorrow Technology Survey.
I just want to give an overview. A team of us went to a technology conference put off by LA County, and one of the speakers, who is from Orange County, actually was the guest speaker, showed us a survey that's being done nationally that they encourage all districts to be a part of. And we'd like to share with you the survey because we think it's very important for our district. It's for parents, students, teachers, administrators, board members, everybody to participate in to give us some really good baseline data to help us develop a strategic plan for technology.
Okay. This is just a brief overview about Project Tomorrow and the Speak Up survey. The survey started in 2003. Since then, over 2 million people have participated in it, and it's provided data each year that is used to share information about how people are thinking and using technology across the nation. Project Tomorrow is they said a nationwide foundation. We're fortunate that one of the key leaders in the organization lives in Orange County, and we have some special access to her in the future. The survey is open right now and has a couple of big goals. It's to collect and report authentic views about technology and the use of technology in education. It will provide schools, districts, states, and the nation with information about the use and thoughts about technology so we can inform our own policies. And I think it gives students a great opportunity to voice their own opinions about technology and instruction. It's facilitated exclusively through school districts, so school districts sign up to participate. And then when you go on to the survey, you identify a school, whether or not you're a parent or student, and take the survey. Like any survey, all of that data is collected and then reported back. There's no fee, there's no cost to the district, but we do get great information back. The information is used by Project Tomorrow to inform the Department of Education and others about, you know, the results and about trends. It takes about 15 or 20 minutes. A number of our principals, teachers, and students have already taken the survey, and that's what they report. It takes about 15 or 20 minutes. And it's really important that we have a great deal of broad representation. So we want students, parents, teachers, principals, district office staff, community members to participate in the survey. Ideally, they say if about 25% of your school community participates, they feel that's very, very reliable information. We have three big reasons to take it, that we get the ideas of all of our stakeholders. It's very easy. We don't have to write our own survey. We just participate. And then, of course, all of these voices are joined together in the nationwide report. The questions in this year's survey, they change each year, but the question themes this year are listed on the slide. So a couple of new things this year. We have not participated in the past, but this year, online assessments, EdTech funding, and reading comprehension in digital media are all new themes that will are new to the program. And the biggest benefit is that we will be able to receive our district's results just as our district. We'll be able to certainly see the whole of the survey, but I think the best thing is that we will be able to look at West Covina results as West Covina's results. And we won't get those results until early spring, but they will be to us, and we will share them with you. The survey is now open. It's open through December 23rd. There is the little website. And then on the back page, there is the secret password for West Covina Unified, which is just a zip code. But you just go to the email address, follow the website instructions, enter the password, and then you can access the survey. And I certainly hope that you all take it, including the audience, too. Good. Okay.
It was really interesting because they shared the results of last year and the difference between what students saw as important and what teachers saw as important and parents was very, very different. And it was one of the few surveys that really take into consideration how students perceive their teaching and learning environment and how the use of technology may or may not enhance it. So it, that was really exciting. But she did offer to come to our district when we get the results and work with our administrative team to not just interpret it, but so what, now what? What do you do with this information, and how does it help you develop a plan going forward?
Is it broken up, elementary and then high school? Is it differentiated that way, or is it?
Yeah, I think it goes down as low as second grade.
And I think it's like the survey for administrators, I think, is probably different than the survey for kids. I mean, as you take it, you can tell the questions are really designed for you. Mm-hmm. But it does go for elementary kids because one of the results she showed us last year, they described a child and how they use technology, and we had to guess if it was a 12th grader, an 8th grader, a 3rd grader, and everyone said, you know, 8th grader or 12th grader, except Miss Valentine here, who got it right, and it was a 3rd grader who,
wow,
who,
yeah,
had actually come up with that. So it's good. It's good information.
Oh, I see.
It says as young as kindergarten.
Is there a way to disaggregate the information to show the responses from each school, or is it just district-wide?
Yes, I believe so.
Yes.
Because you put that in, it's all set up for us. Once we signed on, it sort of customized the survey. So you can pick your school, pick your grade level.
So the charters could participate also because they...
I believe any school can sign up.
Well, Kava would be easy for Kava.
It's just a matter of...
Because Kava would be a lot different than...
Yeah. No, they disaggregate by school.
Okay.
Mr. Spence?
Well, my only question, I was looking at up on my phone, which I didn't do 10 years ago, but I was looking it up and looking at the results from last year, and, you know, I guess there one had jogged something that we had talked about here about the textbooks, trying to look into if it's legal for us to give the option for students if they wanted to have an online or I think book instead of the heavy book.
Right. Yeah.
And did we ever get an answer to that?
Well, okay. Under the Williams settlement, a textbook is still required. However, many of our current publishers have an online version, and our students have access to that. So though at this point we have to assign or issue a book to a student, there's no requirement that they carry it back and forth, so they can still access, and not every textbook is that, but many are. And there's a great deal, I think, of progress in that area, and I would anticipate it's not going to be long before our textbooks are not only online, but they're completely, I guess, flexible is the best way to say it.
And interactive?
Yeah, you can. There are already programs through a couple of foundations that allow you to go on and take particular chapters or sections from textbooks and then customize them to a course. So, for example, at this conference that I went to, I made my own textbook. It was on earth environmental science, I think. I did a whole chapter on earthquakes. I was able to link it to YouTube links and a number of other things. So it is possible to now to really update, for example, a science textbook with truly current science. So I would imagine it's really not going to be long at all that most of that information will come in an electronic format.
Well, that's why I bring it up, is that there's no reason, you know, like for literature, for example, all the ones that are in the public domain, I mean, you can get those free, anywhere, lots of places. And, but one of the reasons I bring it up is that legal, because it says here, 67% would buy one if they could use it, that's nice, but if we can't do that legally, it doesn't matter if all of them would buy it.
I think the trend is going to be that all textbooks will be online. And I think they're predicting by 2015. Right now, the publishers are really behind because all publishers aren't producing textbooks that are digital. But there's a few districts like in Florida where they have adopted that, and all textbooks are. So I think it's definitely our future. And as we look, it's one of the things we're looking at in terms of a strategic plan is what kind of infrastructure do we need to have so that kids can bring their telephones or bring their iPads or whatever and be able to interact with textbooks in that way. I mean, we have to think about that. If that's what it's going to be, 5 to 6 years from now, what do we need to do as a district to be prepared for that? So it's not there now, but it's definitely in the very near future. And it will be legal because that's how...
The last time we did this was a while back, but we probably need to look again at our cell phone policy stuff because... I remember last time it was very. I know we can't be enforcing it the way what was approved by the board then, which was considered loosening it up, So, anyways, but.
We have to look.
It just
kind
of struck me, and I have one of those third graders too that does that kind of thing, like I said. And so, okay, thank you.
Did you have a comment?
I have a question.
Okay.
You were saying if we had the textbooks online, we'd be able to bring our technology to class.
Not yet.
I was going to say, how would you keep them on topic?
Well, I think, we're trying to look ahead of what's really available and what kids are used to using. And I think ideally in the pure world where we'd want to be is that if there would be some point of time where we would be able to, I was trying to talk about this cloud that I know nothing about, but that teachers would actually, people could come into their classroom with whatever device they have, and it could be controlled by the teacher through the teacher's computer so that everybody's able to interact. We're not there yet. We're not going to be there next year, but we're trying to look at all these options to see, where do we want kids to be able to do and know, and how do we provide that? So not yet. But probably not in your lifetime at the district, I'm guessing.
Okay.
But in the future.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is item number 16, the ratification of the agreement for professional services.
Yes. Ms. Shoemaker asked us to look into the professional service agreement with Atkinson, Andelson, Loya, Rood, and Romeo, in particular to Jack Parham. And in looking at all the documents that I had available to me, there were two that were the ones that I focused on. One was the agenda item to the board on July 26th that talked about the services agreement and talked about really the retainer portion of it. When I looked at the actual contract that the district engaged in, there were really two parts to that agreement. One was obviously the retainer where we could make telephone calls, but there was also a piece in there for hourly rate to deal with any kind of litigation or EEOC, anything like that. So there was a discrepancy between the contract that was signed with Atkinson and with what went to the Board of Education. So this is a ratification to ratify the second part of the contract that we actually have been using. What I also did for you was to provide you with an analysis of, I know you've asked for a lot of our attorney's fees, but I tried to provide you with an analysis in terms of which firms we're using and what they're working on and what the costs were per firm. So in this particular ratification, we're raising the impact from $14,700 to $28,000, basically to work on there's two EEOC complaints that Mr. Parham has been working on.
Questions?
This sort of goes back to what I've been asking all summer, which is who gave the initial authorization for Jack Parham to take over the EEOC claims. It's now basically been answered by the fact that there was, in fact, a portion of the retainer agreement that was not disclosed to the Board of Education. Thank you, Ms. Kaplan, for finally getting me that answer. The only question I still have is basically why the interim superintendent, Dr. Garcia, at the time felt it was okay to not disclose the entire contract to the Board of Education and also to allow Jack Parham to take over cases from our counsel in place at the time. But obviously those aren't questions that you are going to be able to answer. It concerned me when this contract first came before the board that Jack Parham was characterized by the superintendent as a buddy of his, and that, you know, they would be used to answer quick questions. For that reason, I voted no at the time. I'm going to vote now no, because, again, I don't know how Jack Parham came in. I don't know why he came in. We have general counsel that could have been handling it. If there was a perceived conflict, that should have been something that was discussed by the board before he took over cases without full board authorization. So I will be voting no on this item.
Any comments? Mr. Spence?
Well, actually, if I remember right, I voted no on this item along with you, Mr. Schumacher. You know, obviously I don't like that Dr. Garcia kind of shifted what was approved by the Board of Education. My difficulty in rejecting it now is that those deadlines for the EEOC complaints are due, and that unfortunately I'm gonna vote for it, because if we don't, we're placing the district at risk in being able to defend ourselves, because we've gone so far in the process with that one with those complaints and in answering them, that to reject it now, which I tend to want to do, but I think we put the district at a financial risk if we did so. So that's just.
Anything else? Is there a motion for this? I'm sorry.
Well, are you able to clarify at all, or you just don't know since you weren't on board, why the board wasn't informed of the extent of the attorney?
Honestly, I don't believe it was just annoying Dr. Garcia. I don't believe there was an intent not to inform the board. I think, you know, during that transition, things happened. I think when you brought Mr. Parham on board, there was not the EEOC that came after the fact. I think there was a feeling by Dr. Garcia that he was getting quicker answers through Jack Parham, and that when the EEOC came, he felt that there was a conflict between the Lozano-Smith and that it just happened. I mean, I don't really, you know, obviously I went back and found these things. I just, in knowing Dr. Garcia, I don't think that was intentionally to keep it from you. I think that was a very, you know, transitional time and things were evolving and things were happening. And I think I do need to say that I think he's been very effective in getting back to us. He's been working on two cases that he's been, I feel very comfortable with the work that he's doing. And I think right now it's in our interest to have him continue.
Well, I was one of the ones who originally voted for it, but this is different than what we voted on. So I'm still going to vote for it, but
I understand.
Right.
Yeah, I think when this is done, we have to deal with that issue. I mean, I really do, because it. I mean, like I said, I'm only voting for it because we're so far into the process. I think it leaves us hanging out there.
I'm used to when I provide a contract to the board, I'm used to providing, I don't know if that was, but I'm used to providing you with the contract as well as the full contract as well as the board agenda item, and I will continue to do that in the future.
So he's not on a retainer anymore, right?
Well, that's the next one.
Oh, okay.
That's the next one. But no, he won't be on the retainer anymore.
The thing with this item is we're ratifying through October 31st, 2011. The next item is their continuing representation of us. Mm-hmm. So I understand the thought that they've done so much work, but what penalty is there for the fact that it wasn't disclosed to the board? Jack Parham and other attorneys at Atkinson are well aware that I brought up to them that what the retainer agreement they had is not what was brought before the board. So for me, voting no on what has already happened is different than on the next item voting for moving forward with them. So.
And again, it was a transition. When I talked to Mr. Parham, he is the one who told me there were two parts to the, in terms of the contract. I don't know that he was aware of what exactly went to the board. I just think it was a transitional time, and, we will do our best to be more transparent and forthcoming in the future.
Well, if there was a yes vote on 16 and a no vote on 17, they would continue as providing the service, but they wouldn't be paid?
For
16?
Well, no. Let me. Should I talk? I might as well talk about both of them at this point. Obviously, I'm new to the district, and I'm working with a lot of attorneys, and for different reasons. So, I met with cabinet to say, and first of all, we did this analysis to really look at what our attorneys were working on, and I met with cabinet, and we really feel that the majority that there's three kind of buckets. One is personnel, and Lozano Smith is working very effectively with our negotiations, and we felt it was not a good time to switch attorneys in negotiations, and we felt that that was appropriate. Lozano Smith has also provided special education counsel to us, and we felt, again, that that's been a comfortable relationship, and we weren't interested in changing that at this point in time. The other piece, as you can see, is the litigation that we're currently involved in, and both through the JPA and through the EEOC, it's kind of the same firm, and I think that's been very helpful in terms of communication and moving that forward on behalf of the district. So my recommendation is we've got to move forward, and we want to support the district. And so I'm not recommending that we put them on as a retainer because I don't find that I'm calling them all the time. We really have these different buckets, and I think that's not an effective use. I think there was a reason for that, but I think that for specific cases or specific issues, I might want to call them for things that pertain to my office. So to get us through this year, I see these different two firms working on two different issues for us, but my recommendation really is as we get into the spring to start looking at other firms and as a board and superintendent interview these firms and come up with a firm that we all feel comfortable would be best in representing us going forward. But for right now where I am and where we are, I think this is the best solution.
Thanks. Is there a motion for item number 16, please?
I'll move it.
It's been moved by Eileen Miranda Jimenez and seconded by Mike Spence to approve the ratifying of the agreement with Atkinson, Anderson, Loya, Rudd, and Romo for legal services from July 26, 2011. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion passes 4-1 with Ms. Shoemaker Voting no. Item number 17, we've already had a brief discussion on that. Are there any other questions with respect to that?
Just quick clarification.
Go ahead.
So the reason we don't have the retainer amount of the 4,100 is because you don't feel it's necessary. You haven't used the 20 hours.
No, I feel I don't. I feel most of the issues that we're dealing with right now is about personnel, and I'm very comfortable working with Lozano Smith on that.
Okay.
It's been moved by Elaine Miranda Jimenez. Is there a second?
I second it.
Thank you. Seconded by Cami Polis to approve the contract with Atkinson, Anderson, Loya, Rudd, and Romo for legal services from November 1st, 2011 through June 30th, 2012. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes 4-1. Jessica Shoemaker voting no. Any further discussion from the board? Nothing. Dates to remember: Friday, this Friday, November 11th, the offices will be closed in remembrance of Veterans Day. November 24th and 5th is 25th is the Thanksgiving holiday, and December 13th is the Board of Education reorganization meeting. And with that, we are adjourned at 8:05.
8:04.